I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Physician David Nash is a prolific writer about healthcare policy, the author and editor of numerous articles and books. He got an outpouring of response about a very personal editorial he wrote several months ago in the Health Policy Newsletter. Losing My Dad was about the sadness he felt about his father's death and what the healthcare system looked like on the receiving end. He wrote that it's fragmented and poorly designed, and the experience has motivated him to make sure that patients get appropriate care and support. The country is embroiled in a contentious debate about health care. David Nash says we are not talking about what's really wrong with the system. He's our guest today on Radio Times. He's the founding dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health. That's on the campus of Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia. Also a professor of health policy. And David Nash, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Why do you think such an overwhelming response to this very personal, short, but very personal editorial that you wrote about your dad?
Well, I think we touched an emotional chord with that piece, and many of our colleagues and peers are in the same age group and have parents who are elderly, and they've been patients, and they understand how fragmented the system is. And it was just an emotional outpouring. We lost track after 175 emails and letters. And Marty, many of the letters made my eyes tear up with their own stories. So it was an unexpected outpouring.
But does it tell you that people in the medical community that you would assume deal with this stuff every day don't talk about it, don't know how to talk about it, that it's all about technology and policy and less about the people involved?
Well, it sure is important to think of it in personal terms, and even in people in our business, doctors, nurses, hospital leaders, pharmacists, everybody has a parent, and they've been patients, and I think finding an outlet to talk about these issues. And when they see somebody who is working and studying the system suffering the same problems as they are, I think they had a sense of kinship with me about the kinds of challenges we were all really facing.
What did your father die of?
Well, you know, that's a great question. My physician brother and I are not exactly sure. Clinically, we believe he had a pulmonary embolism, a fatal blood clot. And like a lot of elderly men, he was on a blood thinner for irregular heart rate. And probably the blood thinner and other challenges, he had a small stroke. And as a result of the stroke, we all decided with his own doctors to stop the blood thinner. And in retrospect, perhaps that may have even been a contributing factor. But he had other underlying issues. But we think the final diagnosis was probably a fatal pulmonary embolism.
Well, it's interesting you and your physician brother and the physician don't know the answer to that question.
That's correct. We do not.
I mean, is that unusual? Is that significant?
I don't think it's unusual, and I don't really think it's significant. A lot of elderly people, unless you do an autopsy, quite frankly, we never really know. He had some mild irregular heart rate. He was overweight. But those were really his only important clinical problems.
You described, though, that he was able to spend time with his family, with his grandchildren, whom he loved. Would you say, gosh, I almost hate to say this, did he have a good death?
Yes, he did. Thank God. Yes, he did. And in part, you know, that's what stimulated me to write the piece, because in our line of work, we know way too many stories of what I would describe as a bad death. And as I know our listeners are aware, in the United States, many elderly persons die a very bad death. And you could go to any hospital intensive care unit in this city and see exactly what it is we're talking about.
Which is that people's lives are extended beyond which they should be. There are surgeries and interventions, that kind of thing. Well, is that a bad death?
Well, my personal view is, unless the family is engaged in the decision-making, sometimes on the medical side, we get carried away. And unless there's a very frank conversation and a living will and a medical directive, unfortunately, many times the medical team has no choice but to proceed with the technology. And what I was most grateful for is my parents both had a living will. They had medical directives that didn't really technically come into play, but we were prepared in case there was a prolonged hospitalization.
But, you know, it's interesting you describe that in very human terms, and it wasn't so long ago people were talking, not you, but people were talking about death panels, that somehow if the government got involved or doctors got involved in these conversations about the end of life, that that was a death panel.
Isn't that sad? And this is one of the many knuckleheaded things going on inside the Beltway. The death panel, actually, that all comes from a scholarly article written by Rahm Emanuel's physician brother. And it was never meant to be a piece of policy, but it got all twisted out of shape, and then you saw the recent Newsweek magazine cover story, should we have talk about Granny's death. The main issue from a policy perspective is, let's have that difficult conversation, and let's have it before Grandma or Grandpa are in the intensive care unit. Medicare, if you look at it from a policy perspective, we're spending way more money in the last 2 months of life than we really ought to. And I think families would have a great sense of relief if they had a moderated discussion with healthcare professionals to talk about the options.
But the way that's often framed is that you have these conversations, you're going to get denied care, that's going to lead to rationing. I mean, you know where that conversation
goes. I see
goes.
Where it leads, and it's really sad and inappropriate from my perspective, the fear-mongering that went on with the death panel conversation, whatever your politics. From a policy perspective, important conversations at the bedside about utilization of resources and about prolongation of life and the pain that it causes not only the family but the patients themselves. So I would urge everybody to have an advance directive and have that conversation and do it before you end up in that situation.
Let me add, though, my own personal note to that. I've been through some of that with both of my parents, and I will say that there's sometimes, as a consumer or the child of a patient, you don't. It's not so clear how to proceed and whether to decide on this next procedure or not. I mean, you are dependent on what medical staff say, and they're obviously dependent on what they think is going to be the best, hopefully the best thing for the patient.
Indeed. But I think as a country, it would be helpful for us to have these conversations and make it a part of the policy conversation about end-of-life care, palliative care, hospice care. You know, this is a medical specialty today, palliative care. Self-select nurses, doctors, pharmacists, training programs. We're going to create a master's degree in chronic care management in our new school in part to tackle exactly this issue. But creating the fear-mongering out of it, well, that's not productive from anybody's perspective.
Going back to this editorial you wrote, you described a fragmented, poorly designed system that relies a lot on consultants and on specialists.
Yes,
is
ma'am.
That the system that we have?
It is indeed the system that we have, and I'm not singling out any individual hospital or doctor, but you can imagine the scenario. I'm here in Philadelphia. My mom and dad were in southeastern Florida. My dad gets admitted emergently to an ICU at a community hospital. My brother, a physician, and I try to communicate with the various specialists. And for us, we're able to reach out and touch whoever we need to. Imagine a family that there are no doctors, nurses, or others in the family. Even with that, I flew to the hospital to meet with the persons in charge. And even with that, the hurly-burly, I got barely 10 minutes of people's time and attention.
Wow. So do we have the most expensive, most dysfunctional healthcare system in the Western world?
Well, it's a tough
call.
Can you
say that?
I think it's you're on solid evidence ground to say it's clearly the most expensive by a wide margin. And dysfunctional, well, let's put it this way. We spend about $7,000 per person, including children, every year. And if you look at any global measure of outcome or societal wellness, we're not anywhere in the top 30 in any measure. So just from an economic perspective, you know, we spend the most. What are we getting for the dollars we're spending? To me, it's an issue of what's the value? What's the return? And just look at how competitive we are on the global stage as a result. And look at all the unhappiness and then health reform. So I think it's a fair statement to say it's about as dysfunctional as it can get.
You also have criticized the way this is being debated and discussed in Washington, both Congress and the White House. And you wrote, "I'm struck that most of the national conversation about health reform has really been about insurance reform. Missing from the national conversation are the crucial issues that face our dysfunctional system." Your word, unexplained clinical variation, waste, the epidemic of medical errors, solving the tort crisis.
Right.
If we though in reform our or improve our insurance system, would we get better outcomes?
Oh, there's no question that we'd get better outcomes if we focused on the issues that matter. And the list that you read, certainly, so let's just pick one or two.
Okay.
The fourth leading cause of death in the United States is medical error. You know, that's a pretty scary fact. And we could quibble, is it 150,000, 250,000? If it's your father, mother, sister, brother, one death is way too many. So one of the issues is, well, let's learn about how to fix and improve and lower the error rate. Healthcare is never going to be error-free. We want it to be harm-free. So let's have a national initiative to tackle that. Well, if we do that, not only will we save lives, but we're going to save a lot of money, too, because we'll reduce waste. We'll get it right the first time. We won't repeat tests we don't need to repeat, and on and on. So the system is all intricately connected. So medical error, that's one area. What about overutilization? Well, you know, we ration care in the United States by zip code. And if you look at a map of the country, there are inexplicable differences in the use of medical services in contiguous zip codes. And then the final part of that story is it turns out the more you spend, the worse the outcome.
Hmm. Well, let me pick up on the first thing you said. We have about a minute before our first break here. Why so many errors in the system? I mean, is it just that it's so complicated? You got so many sort of working parts of the system that don't actually work together?
Yes, it's an incredibly complex system, and we're only now in the last really 5 years importing skills and tools and knowledge from other industries to help us understand it, most especially from commercial and military aviation, from systems engineering. We're understanding that care is a process. And once you understand that care is a complex process, there are tools and other assets that we can bring to bear to help fix and reduce the error rate.
Including things like information and data?
You bet. Electronic medical record as one component of our understanding of the system's nature of care. Reduce that terrible doctor handwriting. Get that prescription delivered electronically. Those are the obvious things. But also it's the sharing of information. Go back to my dad for a moment.
Sure.
Imagine if I had the capability that my dad's doctor said, well, you know, here's my password, go online, let's review your dad's lab test together. Well, wouldn't that have been wonderful? Or let's review your dad's EKG together.
We are talking with internist David Nash today on Radio Times about how he thinks we can improve our healthcare system. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University's College of Information Science and Technology, the iSchool at Drexel, supports WHYY and is hosting an open house on Sunday, October 25th at 9:30 a.m. Prospective graduate students can meet faculty, staff, and alumni and learn about programs in library and information science, information systems, and software engineering. Drexel offers full and part-time studies on campus or online. For information, 215-895-2474 or iSchool.drexel.edu.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are in what we hope is the next to the last day of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We will make our goal when you make a pledge of support. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at whyy.org. We produce 500 hours of live interviews on Radio Times every single year. We have an insatiable curiosity about the world. We want to be challenged and inspired, and we know you do too. Today on the program, program, another in our continuing conversations about our healthcare system. David Nash is our guest. He says the nation is focusing on the wrong parts of our dysfunctional system. Also today on Radio Times, best-selling writer Richard Dawkins, author of The Greatest Show on Earth. Tomorrow, our guest is Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. Make a pledge so that we can continue to bring you in-depth interviews about the important issues of the day. 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, David Nash is our guest. He's a physician and internist, founding dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health. That's at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia, where he's also a professor of health policy. One in probably a billion interviews that we have done so far as we take a look at our healthcare system and what can be done to make it better. And our guest, David Nash, is full of ideas. We have a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just pick up on the error part. You mentioned Dr. Handwriting, which of course is infamous. Right. But it is so curious to me that we're still talking about pencils or pens and papers, you know, in a trillion-dollar healthcare system. And we hear about other systems, other countries with different systems, and it's all computerized,
largely computerized. On its way to be all computerized. Certainly, some nations, Germany's a great example, where patients are in large part in control of their own medical record. We call that the personal health record. And the way it works there, at least in primary care in Germany, patients bring their little memory stick to the doctor. They give the doctor their password, and then the doctor can stick the stick in the computer and up comes their medical record. So what does that do? Well, the patient is the source of control. And that flows from basically nothing about me without me. That's the goal.
Right.
And then the doctor works with the patient in this sort of system to enter material onto the medical record. Well, just think about the sort of partnership model that creates. Well, that's not for everybody at this moment in our country, not for every patient, certainly not for every doctor. That's not what we currently teach.
No.
And many patients are scared about maintaining their own record. But I think when I think about the generation of doctors in training currently at Jefferson and elsewhere, they're ready for this. They grew up with this sort of technology. They want to know how come we're taking so long.
But it seems like there's a kind of inertia or resistance that's built into the system. And I realize, you know, people don't change unless they really have to.
Right.
But we're talking about, you know, a nationwide, a system that clearly has to change because it's really unsustainable.
Well, let's talk about how that relates to health reform. So, again, I'm going to use the difficult term, the knuckleheadedness going on in Washington. I think there are really four pillars, if you would, to reform. And if you think of it this way, it sort of simplifies things, even for guys like me who do this every day. So, number one, we have to figure out a way to create value in the system. We're spending the most, and we don't have a lot to show for it. Number two, we have to insure everyone. It's a moral obligation. How we do it, et cetera, certainly we could talk about.
Right.
And that's probably what, if anything good comes out of the conversation in D.C., it'll be that. That's pillar two. Pillar three, we got to promote prevention and wellness. We're practicing what epidemiologists would call tertiary and quaternary prevention when in Philadelphia, Marty, 13% of the population has diabetes.
Wow.
27% of the population smokes. So let's tackle that instead of building the 15th open heart surgery program and adding the 10th helicopter, and you get it. And the fourth pillar is what related to your previous question, coordinate care.
Mm-hmm.
So if you pay doctors and hospitals to coordinate care, you know what we're going to do tomorrow? We're going to coordinate that care.
And what we have now is essentially fee-for-service.
We have
right?
piecework.
I prefer
the term piecework. Everybody understands that.
Okay.
We have 18,000 billing codes, not a one for coordinating care.
And you're saying that if doctors or people within the I guess it is doctors, right? If they were paid to coordinate care, they would
we
coordinate
We would do it tomorrow.
Care.
Absolutely.
But how would you do that? I mean, we don't have a blackboard here, but
okay.
How would you do that?
So we could start, and you've heard very little about this. Have you ever heard President Obama say that let's do a better job coordinating care and practicing prevention? Well, maybe once in a blue moon. So the idea there might be, let's take Medicare and set up 100 demonstration projects. So let's declare 4 states that in these states, we're going to pay hospitals and doctors a lump sum, what we'll call a bundled payment. And then hospitals, doctors, and nurses have to work together to figure out how to divide up the economic pie. Well, boy, oh boy, we'll be in a room that night trying to figure that out.
But didn't we try that? Wasn't that what managed care was supposed to be?
Not really. No, not really. We did have episodes of bundled payment in the mid-90s for a few hospitals in the South for open heart surgery. And guess what? It worked amazingly well.
You have written that the public plan, and there's a lot of talk about the public plan.
Yes.
In fact, that seems to be the number one conversation about whatever happens to the healthcare system. You call it a straw man. How come?
Yeah, maybe that's a little strong, but I've been trying to read the political tea leaves, and I don't pretend that my crystal ball is any clearer than anybody else's or that I have a private line to the White House basement. But clearly to me, the public option is silly because what do we need it for? We already have both not-for-profit and for-profit insurance companies, managed care plans. We have a national accreditation process. To attack the insurance industry and make them the whipping boy for what's wrong misses the four pillars we just talked about. They're a convenient target. The public option would only add to that mess. And I think the for-profit and not-for-profit insurance industry has a real beef about, well, then that public option could put at risk the entire insurance industry, which would only then worsen the reimbursement problem we have. That's part one. And part two, I think, frankly, it was a political deal that the Liberal Democrats wanted to have this public option to talk about. All the while, my hunch is the White House was going to use this as a baseball trading card, give it away when they needed to prove that they could compromise.
But the argument for it is that a public option would force competition in states where there isn't, let me just finish, okay,
right.
Where there isn't enough competition, thereby through competition it would lower costs.
Yeah, well,
and we also hear those anecdotes about private insurance companies, you know, refusing care to people because
sure.
There was a story recently, or in fact, I think it was today or yesterday, a woman actually had been raped, and they saw that as a pre-existing condition. And so,
makes the news for sure.
Well, it does, but
right.
But that has been an argument, and it seems to be resonating with a lot of people.
Well, and in part, you know, sure. Are there abuses on both sides? Of course. Are hospitals blameless? Are insurance companies blameless? Certainly not. But I just don't understand the what would be gained from a policy perspective to implement a federally run public option plan. You know, Medicare is not an insurance company. Medicare is a bill-paying apparatus that's maturing into a modest, savvy shopper in the best of days. So to create a public plan, that's just going to muddy the waters. It'll be very poorly run. It'll be an administrative nightmare. And to claim that there's no competition in the insurance industry, well, that's just silly. It's just not accurate.
The thing that you say is, and just following up on some of your writing about this, is that what's needed is then real reform of healthcare financing.
Exactly.
That gets to, but wouldn't the insurance industry fight back, push back on that?
Well, it's an interesting point. Back in June, the America's Health Insurance Plans, basically the lobby, AHIP, they had a love fest in June in the White House. The leader of AHIP, Karen Ignani, a major force in Washington, she and President Obama were virtually hugging. In the last week, it seems to me, the White House has declared war on Karen and her company. Again, they're an easy target. It doesn't get us back to the four pillars. We've got to cover everyone because that's the only way the business of insurance works, by getting the most people covered. We'll share the risk. We'll have more people paying into the system. The public option doesn't affect that in any way. The key is to cover everybody. How we do it, should it be based at the site of employment, should it be a tax, whatever, we could quibble about the details. But a core pillar is covering everyone. Share the risk. Then the pool of money available when you need care is available.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We got a full bank of calls here. That tends to happen when we talk about health care, health insurance. David Nash, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an internist here in Philadelphia, the founding dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health, and that's on the campus of Thomas Jefferson University, where he's also a professor of health policy and one of many guests we've had on Radio Times as we all try to figure out how our system, our healthcare system, works and how it can be improved. It's a system that he describes as dysfunctional in many ways. Let me get to Lena from Huntington Valley to join our conversation. Lena, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
My father, Dr. Ira Sharp, is also an internist here in Philadelphia and graduate of Jefferson Medical School. And just seeing him over the years, you know, kind of tired. He loves what he does with a passion, being a primary care physician. And he makes a comfortable living, but there's a great disparity between what he makes and what, you know, specialists and radiologists, you know, just for example, can earn. And being, you know, that in this trillion-dollar healthcare system, you have all these extra costs, and, you know, patients go into the emergency room if they don't have health insurance, and perhaps, you know, having more complicated situation at that point, whereas if the primary care physicians, which are the first-line people to make a diagnosis, were, you know, the most competent to make that diagnosis, you know, where if we had the best doctors, I guess is what I'm trying to say, being internal medicine doctors and making these diagnoses, perhaps you wouldn't have as many people ending up in the emergency room, you know, and preventative care could be bolstered and augmented. And I guess my question to you is, you know, with the fact that primary care medicine doctors perhaps don't, you know, earn the same living as other specialists in our current medical system do, are there incentives being offered for
it's a good question.
Medical students to pursue that field?
It's a good question, and it raises another point to talk about. David Nash, go ahead.
Sure. Well, that's a great question. Let's see if we could split it into two pieces. From a policy perspective, our country is very different than every other Western developed nation in that our ratio of specialists to primary care doctors is 3-1. In wow. every other nation, it's 3 primary care doctors to every specialist. So what does that do? Well, you know, there's an old saw in our business. When you have a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody overutilizes, but you've been reading Atul Gawande's wonderful piece in The New Yorker. You've read the Atlantic Monthly cover story. You can't help but think that if we had more primary care doctors, we certainly could do the two pillars of care. We could coordinate care, and we could promote prevention. Would that eventually lead to lower costs? You bet.
Hmm.
So how do we do that? Well, we've got to change the economic incentives. We have to balance the payment between primary care doctors and specialists. One way we might do that is offer the hospital a bundled payment. Then we sit around a table and figure out who gets what. So instead of it being procedurally driven and you're only going to get paid when you do A, B, C, and D, and E, let's say, hey, here's a pot of money. You're in charge of this population of patients with diabetes. You go figure out how to pay each other.
But what if you have the patient that comes in and says, you know, I want the most, they're not going to say it this way, I want the most expensive procedure that you have because
Great.
I want it.
Yeah. And every doctor knows exactly what you're talking about, Marty, myself included. Sure. Do patients create demand? Is there induced demand with advertising? Absolutely. So we have to have patients have a little bit more skin in the game. So, for example, look, maybe you don't need that MRI, maybe you do, but there is a reality that it's going to be $1,100 out of pocket. And maybe for your tennis elbow, we could wait to see how the anti-inflammatory drugs do. And in 4 weeks, if you're still not better, well, okay, you know, we'll go ahead and do the test. That's just one of thousands of kinds of clinical examples. But yes, patients drive demand. There's no question about it, especially because they're protected from the true cost of the tests and procedures.
Even though I think a lot of people, myself would included, say, well, the copays today are a lot higher than they were a year or so
ago. Out-of-pocket costs in real dollars, I know it's hard to believe, out-of-pocket costs in real dollars have been stable for a decade.
Compared to, obviously, inflation, I mean,
That's right.
Because I think people feel like they are paying more out-of-pocket for
stuff. And the evidence from consumer-directed health plans and some of the other sort of tools that are out there going way back to the RAND health insurance experiment 30 years ago, if patients have economic skin in the game, they tend to make very different clinical decisions than when they are totally protected from the true cost.
Of course, you need to make that fair, you need to have everyone have health insurance.
There you go. Right? One of the four pillars. Cover everyone.
I wonder, too, speaking about patients, and of course, and you mentioned the fact that chronic illnesses really drive so much of the expense of our system, but also, and I think for a lot of people, you know, you point to the insurance industry, to the doctors, to the hospitals, but, you know, Americans as a group are not particularly healthy. We don't take very good care of ourselves.
No, we don't, and the evidence is pretty scary. So let me put some numbers on this. If you were to ask, there's very good survey information that we could talk about. So, for example, what percentage of adult Americans do the following four things? They don't smoke. They regularly wear a seatbelt. They eat their fruits and vegetables, and they're pretty close to appropriate body weight. Well, the answer is
3%.
3%? 3%. And it's been repeated and studied, solid data, University of Michigan, et cetera. So if only 3% of the population does sort of the key things we really think are important for primary prevention, well, we have a huge opportunity there, don't we?
We do.
For patient education and so on. Let's focus back on Philadelphia. 13% of the population has diabetes. 27% of all adults smoke. So let's have primary prevention. My own personal view is make cigarettes $15 a pack or more. And let's put a tax on sugary soda and on and on. Now, you know, people consider that Big Brother. But guess what? We're all paying right now for this sort of behavior. Another way to look at it, let's go back to diabetes. On a national level, if you believe the numbers, and I think they're accurate, one out of every three Medicare dollars goes to care for patients with diabetes and the complications of diabetes. One out of three. So if you round it off, it's about a little over $1 billion a day from Medicare to doctors and hospitals together. So one third of that, well, that's a lot of money.
Yes.
And then if you say, well, okay, how are we doing in the care of the patients who have diabetes? Well, we get it right about half the time based on solid evidence for all kinds of complicated reasons. So, I mean, just think of that in your mind's eye. If we only get it right half the time and one third of a billion a day is going to this one disease, yikes, is a huge opportunity just to tackle a chronic important illness in our own city like diabetes.
And we're almost, again, up on a break, our second break here, but is that an argument for our caller saying more investment in primary care?
Absolutely. More investment in primary
care.
So
when people come into that initial office visit,
right,
there's someone there to help them.
Right. Let's get that nurse educator, that diabetes educator. Let's have a video and a CD they could take home. Let's have a dietitian go over their diet. But if everybody is paid to do piecework, I'm not going to hire those people to help me. If I get a lump sum to keep people out of the hospital, I'm going to bring all those resources to bear, and I'm going to promote and practice a different kind of medicine.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and our callers. We are talking about our healthcare system with our guest, physician David Nash. And we have just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about. Talking today on Radio Times about our health care system, our health insurance system, and what to do about it. And our guest, David Nash, is founding dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health, and that's here in Philadelphia. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Philadelphia College of Pharmacy at University of the Sciences was the first educational institution in North America to teach pharmacy. The founders of six pharmaceutical companies were PCP graduates. The practice of pharmacy is a healthcare profession that blends science and patient care. The Philadelphia College of Pharmacy offers a Doctor of Pharmacy degree. Full details are online at usp.edu/PCP.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and we are in what we hope is the next to the last day of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. We will make our goal when you make a pledge of support. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We produce 500 hours of live interviews on Radio Times every single year. We have an insatiable curiosity about the world. We want to be challenged and inspired, and we know you do too. Today on the program, another in our continuing conversations about our healthcare system. David Nash is our guest. He says the nation is focusing on the wrong parts of our dysfunctional system. Also today on Radio Times, best-selling writer Richard Dawkins, author of The Greatest Show on Earth. Tomorrow, our guest is Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. Make a pledge so that we can continue to bring you in-depth interviews about the important issues of the day. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with physician David Nash about how to improve our healthcare system. Let me get Carolyn from Asheville, North Carolina to join us. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have two, and I will make them brief, stories that have happened to me recently that really emphasize what Dr. Nash is speaking about this morning. And the first one is a lifetime friend whose father is 90 in a VA hospital with Alzheimer's and has been diagnosed with an abdominal aortic aneurysm. Wow. And the doctors there want to do surgery so they can prolong his life from approximately 2 to 4 years. And again, the man is 90 with Alzheimer's and very frustrated and unhappy. So my friend, whose father this is, has refused to put him through this ordeal, but I think that situation speaks loudly for itself. But the second thing is that my 85-year-old aunt died in August, and she was taken from an assisted living facility to her local hospital in Georgia. And she had everything in place for her living will, do not resuscitate. All of her end-of-life wishes were in place. The hospital had all of this on record, as did the assisted living facility where she lived. She also wore a bracelet on her right arm with these instructions so that everything was visible and in place. Unfortunately, when she was taken to the hospital for what appeared to be pneumonia, she did die. Her family was with her when she stopped breathing, rang for the nurse to notify her immediately. The hospital resuscitated my aunt, but she was without oxygen for so long that there was no brain function, and she was then moved into ICU, where she was given blood transfusions. And the hospital could not find her end-of-life information had not been transferred to her current stay in the hospital. Someone had cut off the bracelet with all her medical information and do not resuscitate. And my aunt then lingered on in ICU. The family was put through absolute torment over this because my aunt's wishes had not been followed, had been overwritten.
You know, and Carolyn, what I hear is actually some connection between these two stories. And let me give our first of all, I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to do this. We got a lot of people on the line. You put two very poignant stories on the table. I think speaks to what we've been talking about, Carolyn. And I appreciate the call. And let me see what David Nash has to say.
Well, thanks for sharing, and I my heart goes out to you and your family. Surely. But again, it gets back to a great question Marty asked earlier about the death squads. So here's two great examples. Let's have the Hospital Ethics Committee. By the way, we're required by accrediting practices to have one. Let's get them involved in sorting through these issues. Let's have an open conversation. And, you know, clearly fixing a AAA, an aortic aneurysm on a 90-year-old with Alzheimer's, well, you know, frankly, that violates do no harm. And so I would want to talk with that team for sure. The second story is regrettably familiar. The cutting off of the armband, and then the hospital is in a very difficult position without proof of the family's wishes, putting us at risk. Unfortunately, we even have confusion over the color code of the bracelets calling for no resuscitation. It's only very recently that we've started to standardize these colors. I know it's hard to believe.
That is hard to believe.
But both stories are poignant, and both point to lack of coordination, lack of communication, no financial incentive to have the difficult conversation, financial incentives in all the wrong direction. Everything we've been talking about, you're right, Marty, it illustrates all the ills in just those two stories.
And Carolyn, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. On the last example, as you said, hospitals, perhaps this hospital felt needed to do something.
Right.
Was it for fear of a lawsuit? I mean, does that hang over some of these decisions?
Well, clearly, in the day-to-day hurly-burly, we are always worried about the tort issues, so-called defensive medicine. You know, does it affect every single decision? Well, it depends on who you ask. In Philadelphia, ground zero at one time of the malpractice crisis, I think it would be fair to say it affected the majority of decisions. Now, we're out of the danger zone in that regard, but this is a problem that's not going to go away. We're not here to talk about tort reform. Is it a driver of utilization? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
How much? The experts disagree. The round numbers, about 10%, 8 to 10% of total costs can probably be attributed to what you and I would call defensive practice. Well, 10% of a trillion plus is a lot of money.
And defensive medicine is doing something for fear that if
right.
you don't do
without
it,
without that armband, who knows what that family really wanted? And also, just let me add, when hospitals deal with families, a family is not a unified entity. Brothers and sisters don't talk to one another. Some are more politically connected than others. Some want to, you know, inherit the money, and on it goes. So from a physician perspective, it's not a unified group giving you their single agreed-upon opinion.
Let me get Jason from Voorhees, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Jason. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Wow. There's a lot of different things we could talk about
Indeed.
Here. you know, I just wanted to go over a couple things real quick. You had talked about medical errors being such an important part of the causes of death in the country. You're also talking about information sharing. And when you got into the four pillars, you were talking about coordinating care. And I'm not going to go into my background and my experiences on both sides of the Atlantic in healthcare, but I also wanted to get away from the reform in healthcare insurance and talk more about the actual healthcare reform. And this past summer, I had the chance to participate in an international conference that was actually held here in Philadelphia for the Institute of Patient and Family-Centered Care.
Great.
And my first question was, I want to have the chance to ask two questions here. My first question was, how important is patient and family-centered care delivery in healthcare, not just across the country, but also in Philadelphia? And then my second question was actually this is something I always hear my wife say all the time. She's always talking about top docs, or you're always hearing hospitals talk about the top docs.
Right.
And her comment is always, there's no top docs.
Jason, hold on one second. And I appreciate the fact that people want to pick our brains, our guest's brain, and try to get answers to all these important questions. But let me just take the first one, because we haven't spent a lot of time. We touched on this notion of family, patient-centered care. But what does that mean?
Well, it's a great term, and I appreciate the caller bringing that up. So let's go back to 2001. And the publication of a very important book by the Institute of Medicine in Washington called Crossing the Quality Chasm. Now, the details probably not important, but this book, this 2001 critically important book by experts, laid out what the vision for healthcare should be in our country in the future. And they described six so-called domains or characteristics. Not surprisingly, making the system safe was the number one priority, but patient-centeredness was one of the six domains. What does that really mean? Well, I think it means, frankly, nothing about me without me. I want to understand what's going on. I want to be able to ask questions. I want good answers to my question. I want to participate in the decision-making process. But there's another side to it, too. I promise to take my medicine. I promise to show up for my appointment. I promise to lose weight. This is a two-edged problem, and we're not going to fix healthcare without primary prevention and patient participation in those activities. So patient-centeredness cuts both ways.
But it sounds very mature.
Yes, it does.
Very grown up. And and as you were describing that, I was thinking, it seems like we have a very juvenile healthcare system, and even a lot of the attitudes on all sides.
Well, right? If only 3% of the population does those critical activities, I think it's fair to say we have a room for improvement.
You've also written about figuring out what works and then doing what works.
Yes.
We don't do that enough.
Well, let me summarize what the experts tell us. And again, we call something a randomized controlled trial evidence. It's a fancy way we describe evidence that comes from research about what really works. And we call that grade A from a randomized controlled clinical trial. Well, we have grade A evidence for what we do at the bedside for 1 out of 5 decisions. The other 4 decisions, we have other grades of evidence, and I'll just summarize that by saying expert opinion is what we call level D evidence. A being a good grade,
right.
D being not such a good grade.
Right.
And so those 4 out of 5 decisions, that's in part experience, the art of medicine. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we could increase the evidentiary basis to 40% of what we do, 50, 60, and more? And that's where you've heard this somewhat cumbersome term, comparative effectiveness research, such a bugaboo. What is it? Hard to even pronounce. Well, Uncle Sam wants to give us more research dollars to help doctors, nurses, pharmacists, places like Jefferson figure out what's the best way.
Hmm.
What's going to give us the best result? So, in summary, it is scary but true that we have solid, great scientific evidence for about 1 out of 5 decisions we make.
Yikes. Let me get Tracy from Newport, Rhode Island to join us. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi.
I
was just curious in talking about the cost of healthcare that, you know, I have had many in vitro procedures, for instance, and I'm always aware of the copay, but never aware of the true cost of anything that I have, any procedure, any medications that I have received.
Great.
And I just question whether, you know, I would just like to have my own oversight over my own healthcare.
Wonderful.
and know what things are costing. And maybe I have a question here and there about prices or... I don't know. Just curious.
No, it's a great question. And David Nash, I know you want to respond.
Great question. And as our listeners know, some medical centers here and there, and I certainly would concur that they believe transparency and accountability, those are the themes for the future. Maybe another way to look at this, you know, sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Hmm.
Let's just put it out there. Here's what it costs at Jefferson. Here's what it costs at Temple. And we could quibble what does even cost mean. But sure, let's be more transparent. This is what the resources are necessary for us to do the job we do. And guess what, patients? Here's your level of real participation. I do believe that you know, there's solid evidence. When patients want a less expensive generic drug, that's where they go. Just ask Walmart. I mean, they're smart. So if we involve patients, that's really what we're talking about. So that gets back, Marty, to patient-centeredness.
Right.
That means you're going to be a part of this mature conversation.
The operative word. Tracy, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And that's David Nash, our guest. He's a physician and an internist here in Philadelphia, also founding dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health. That's on the campus of Thomas Jefferson University. He's also a professor of health policy at Jefferson. And our guest today on Radio Times, a continuing conversation or a series of conversations as we talk about our healthcare system. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And thank you, Marty. I am Susan Greenbaum, one of the producers of Radio Times, here with my colleague Craig Santoro, reminding you and just taking a quick break from Radio Times to tell you that what we really would like to do is hear from you with your support for our fall membership campaign, hoping you will take a moment, give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Become a member online, whyy.org. Craig, I hope you agree, another interesting hour of Radio Time. Still another take on healthcare reform from David Nash, a local physician and healthcare policy expert. Talking about some difficult things about healthcare reform. What end-of-life care costs our system, difficult choices and concessions we all may have to make if we want to make some serious reforms in healthcare delivery, a thoughtful conversation which I hope you have appreciated.
And he really brought out the human cost of, yep, of a broken healthcare system, and it's that personal level that makes these shows so wonderful. And the way that we can take a full hour and go in depth and cover this issue from those angles. If you make a web pledge at whyy.org, you can leave a message for us to tell us how much you appreciate Radio Times and WHYY. Here's one from Zach in Cherry Hill. Zach says, WHYY is the epitome of quality. Fair and balanced news programming, Radio Times, Fresh Air, and all of your local programs are a treasure, and I'm proud that they are produced in Philadelphia. I listen every day.
Well, thank you to him. In case you're someone who listens every day, let me remind you that it's a good day tomorrow at Radio Times. In hour one, we've scheduled an interview with Governor Ed Rendell. He's coming in to sit down with Marty. And in hour two, for those of you who are avid readers, Janet Walls, who is the author of The Glass Castle, a best-selling book that was, I know, a subject of a lot of book clubs, etc., is in here with Marty to talk about her new book, a sort of quasi-memoir, a fictional memoir. So our hunch is that you're listening, that you hear Marty day in and day out, that you value the range of subjects she covers, that you agree that she enriches your day. Please do take a moment, become a member of WHYY, 1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. You trust her. Now we're going to trust you to support what you hear on your public radio station, 1-888-345-9499.
We say that these programs are made possible by your pledges, and we mean that. They would not be possible. We would not be able to put this wonderful programming on the air if people like you did not call up and share a little bit of their hard-earned money with us.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is public radio, and it's over 50% of our operating budget. So give us a call. 1-888-345-9499. Become a partner in making this programming possible, or make a web pledge at whyy.org.
And we can sweeten the deal a little bit for those of you who are news junkies, like those of us at WHYY are. If you put your pledge, whatever level, on a credit card and ask for it, we will send you a year subscription to Newsweek magazine. Newsweek has a new format. We read it at Radio Times, and my hunch is you do too. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. Craig, it has been a really interesting week here at Radio Times. The other